Jim Gamble, hello.
Well, hello there.
When we talk about traditional knowledge, for people that are hearing about this for the first time, how do we define it and what exactly are we talking about?
Well, traditional knowledge, and I think that's a very good question because I think there is often confusion about just what it is and what it isn't. And the way I would answer that question is to talk about the way it's been defined in an Arctic Council context. And that's been done by bringing together the six permanent participant organizations that represent the indigenous people of the Arctic to the Arctic Council. And the six PPs, as we call them, came together in a series of meetings during the Canadian chairmanship of the Arctic Council. So that was from about 2 to about 4 years ago. And they came up with a definition of traditional knowledge. It basically says that traditional knowledge is a way of knowing that's embraced by indigenous peoples, not just in the Arctic, but everywhere. And this way of knowing is a way of interacting with the environment. It's a way of knowing the environment. And it is a growing, expanding, ever-changing set of knowledge that's passed from generation to generation. For a very long time, there's been a recognition that indigenous people possess a sort of a special and significant knowledge about the land. Where the problem has come in is that the Western scientific method that we're all very used to is a method that relies on essentially proof of concept and of documentation and of citation. And so when you talk about traditional knowledge, which is often oral in nature, in other words, passed from generation to generation orally, and is often a sort of, again, a way of knowing that's quite different from what we consider to be traditional Western science, the information that traditional knowledge provides to science seems quite anecdotal. In other words, it's experiences, but it's not backed up by documented facts. And so oftentimes it was discounted or it was ignored completely with regard to science. Now, what we've seen in the last really beginning about 10 years ago and really sort of accelerating in the last maybe 3 to 5 years has been a recognition that in reality, traditional knowledge possesses the possibility of providing information that's very difficult, if not impossible, to obtain any other way than in considering traditional knowledge. Because indigenous people live on the land, they're there on a day-to-day basis, they've seen it in all its forms, they've been watching it change for generations. Indigenous people are able to provide this information that in reality, Western science, it just simply can't obtain. And I think, again, a good example of this is the Arctic Council, because as part of the process I described earlier in the Canadian chairmanship, the Arctic Council also developed a set of recommendations on how best to include traditional knowledge in the work of the Arctic Council. And I think that was very strong recognition that the use of traditional knowledge really should be contemplated in each and every project and to make a determination if it applies, if it's feasible to try to gather it, and how best to do that.
What challenges are you still hearing about, and are they different, you know, in the North American Arctic compared to the European Arctic, for example?
Well, that's a good question, and I would say that there are some very consistent challenges across the North, and some of those are exactly the sort of things you would expect, and what they kind of boil down to, in a way, is a few things. One is that really to include traditional knowledge in a project, the traditional knowledge element has to be thought out and considered from the very beginning. So in other words, you can't make up your research questions and then go in and see, oh, well, maybe traditional knowledge will fit. I mean, a better way is to consider traditional knowledge when you're making up the very questions you want to ask. And so considering it at that early stage in a project, that's not natural, I wouldn't say, for a lot of institutions. And so getting past that sort of barrier, that initial thought barrier, is something we need to work on. The other thing is that including traditional knowledge, it requires more resources. I mean, because traditional knowledge is very person and place-based, that means that you've got to go to the place and you've got to talk to the people. And that requires resources. And really, this process of consultation it has to, again, start at the very beginning when the research questions are being gathered. It has to continue through the process of data gathering, and it also implies coming back and discussing your findings. So that people in who possess traditional knowledge, who live in the community, can look at your findings and have a chance to comment on them and possibly point out errors in methodology or things that might have been missed. And so all of that takes resources. And so building in resources for that and time for that, that can be a challenge. I think another thing that really has to be considered early on in a project is that this knowledge belongs to the people in these communities, the indigenous peoples of these communities. And so they have to give permission to have it used. And so that means that you can't assume that in your context of your project that that's going to happen. You have to go, you have to explain what you're doing, you have to gain trust. A big part of it is trust. Understanding that, I think, makes things just work a lot smoother.
What's at stake for the rest of the world if indigenous knowledge isn't better incorporated into things like climate change research in the Arctic?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because something we talk about a lot, and it's been said in many ways, but the simple truth is that indigenous people are at the leading edge of climate change. They are the ones that are most affected by it. And they are, in fact, disproportionately affected, because they are dealing with the consequences of actions that are beyond their control. So, in other words, they are not the societies that are emitting greenhouse gases. They are not the societies that have sort of brought this problem on. But they are the ones that have to deal with it first, particularly in the Arctic, where climate change is happening fastest. So, considering the traditional knowledge of indigenous communities in the Arctic and elsewhere. Number one, it's morally right, because these are the people that have to deal with climate change to the greatest extent. So that's one factor. Now, another factor is, and I alluded to it earlier, and that is that in reality, there is no way to provide or obtain some of the information, some of the observations, some of the data that traditional knowledge can provide any other way. So that means that if you're not using it, if you're not considering it, that means you're missing something. Now, that doesn't mean that the science you're doing isn't good. The science you're doing is probably could be very, very good. But what it means is that you are missing the opportunity for more. And so in something like the critical nature of climate change, where its consequences are going to affect us all to some extent or another, having all the data is vitally important. And so the opportunity to get these extra data points, that's too good to miss, and it's worth the additional resources and the additional time. And what it makes is a win-win situation for everybody, because indigenous people have something to offer in all of this, and they have something to gain, too, in having all of the data out there to be considered when it comes to policy decisions that are going to affect them and everyone else in the global population.
Jim Gamble, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate being able to talk to you.